You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
So I'd kind of been this invisible kid in school, not popular, just not, you know, nobody you would notice especially. And then suddenly I'm in this band, and then once the record starts selling and people are familiar with the band, well, I was never like, you know, tabloid level famous or anything, but enough so that we could do these tours and, you know, you get a lot of attention all of a sudden. And then, you know, you're in this town and you're, you know, around the venue, all the bars and maybe record stores around the, you know, there's people that are going to your concert, and suddenly, you know, they recognize you and they want it. And it's just, it's very strange. It's very strange to get used to that.
Welcome to another episode of 2020. My name is Corey Peza. I'm here as always with Siobhan Cronin and this fucking weirdo pointing at the screen, Benny Goodman. What's going on, guys?
Hey, guys.
What did the ocean say to the beach?
I don't know.
Nothing. It waved.
Oh, that was good. Oh my gosh.
This is a very visual episode already, so make sure you check out the YouTube.
Well, I'm trying to reiterate that they need to go to YouTube.
Yes.
Or through 2020-d.com, because everything's all in one place, because I know that it's, your life is...
It's hard to keep track, you know, it's too many things.
But you can subscribe to every one of the things that you need, the Spotify's and the Apples and the Googles and whatever. It's all there.
It's like people that message you on Facebook and then they DM you on Instagram and then there's a TikTok and all this stuff. And I'm like, why can't we just talk on the phone?
Yeah, it's centralized.
So 2020-d.com.
Yeah, why don't you just turn the little dial and put in my five numbers and we'll talk.
And 2020-d, aka 2020, is our podcast. And on our podcast this week, we have the amazing, our job is way too fun at this point, Alex Skolnick, who's played in some little bands in the past.
Testament! Also,
Alex Skolnick Trio, author, composer, knows everything.
He's just...
Read his book.
Yeah, just an amazing,
He's
amazing
exactly
episode.
Who he pretends to be.
Yeah. Without giving too much away, we go down, we kind of hear his background, you know, how he got started, you know, joining this, like, iconic thrash band. He was 16 when he joined Testament.
Oh, yeah, that's right. After a few years, he matured. And, like then he found his voice by, like, 19.
You know, he's just got a great story. He took lessons with Joe Satriani. He's played with everyone. Super interesting guy. Check it out. This is part one with Alex Skolnick.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 2020. If you haven't subscribed yet, went to like it, please go to 2020-d.com. We have some amazing guests, obviously, this week, all the other weeks. There's so many things to hear in here, so please go check it out if you haven't already.
That's like a drug dealer saying that his pot is bad. Why would we ever say we have bad guests? We just kind of gloss over that. But, like, I mean, not all of our guests are good. Some of them are better than others.
You didn't even allow me to introduce anything yet.
I'm rude.
Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, before I even get to introduce myself, that is Benny Goodman.
Hello.
I'm Siobhan Cronin, here also with my other co-host, compatriot, what do we call ourselves? Cohorts, Corey Peza.
Been called much worse, but
yeah,
glad to be
exactly.
here.
Why better?
But more important than all three of us, we have an incredible guest this week, and I'm actually in the middle of reading his book right now, which I have to commend you on. It's really entertaining, and I read a lot, and I'm pretty critical of writers. So I mean, not that I'm a writer myself, but it's really, really engaging.
If you were a guitar player, I would say the suspension of disbelief as to reading a book would be a little bit much. But considering you play violin, you're a little more highbrow than the rest of us.
Oh my gosh. But anyway, before we get carried away, the amazing Alex Skolnick of Testament, so many other projects, such an interesting story. Yeah, you have such an interesting story that I don't even know how to introduce you, but I'm halfway through your book and I'm just like, I feel like I've been hanging out with you all week. So anyone that hasn't read this yet, please order it.
Geek to Guitar Hero by Alex Skolnick. Alex, where can they go find it?
You can get it on Amazon, or there's links on my website.
Is that a .net or is it a .com, the Amazon thing?
Either. Ugh.
I think I got it from your website.
Yeah, the main one is .com. I have .net for my podcast, which is called Moods and Modes. I may as well mention that. And sure. I have photography on the .net as well.
It's always scary when we have someone that has a podcast because they're going to realize that we're just complete frauds. We have no idea what we're doing.
Well, it's also scary when someone actually knows modes and I say I'm playing the Phrygian and they're like, no, dude, that's not, that's just harmonic minor. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So Alex, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing? How is this year going for you? What's life like for you?
Oh, I'm on your podcast, so I think
so things
I've
aren't
made
going
it,
well.
I think
so. Not so great.
He's been 2020, yeah. Which is the name of our podcast, by the way, right. Which we never said.
Right, but now it's 2021. Yeah, it's been very, very interesting. I think today the 3rd. I think it's been almost exactly a year since I returned from tour, which was my last touring. Period, which, you know, none of us knew at the time. And it's been a very different year. You know, I think it's a mixed blessing. A lot of very cool things have happened. I've wanted to get my podcast together for the longest time, and it came together, and it's on the Osiris Network, and I just had a dream guest. I don't always have guests. I do different types of shows. Some of it's more like This American Life. It's like radio short stories.
Nice.
But I just had a dream guest I can't even talk about yet, but I'm like pinching myself.
And oh, that's
awesome.
That
would be like 2 episodes from now. Yeah. And so that came together. A lot of collaborations came together that wouldn't have happened otherwise. It just seems like every week there's a collaboration. And I've got a packed schedule between the collaborations, the podcast. I'm writing another book. This is more of a method book for Hal Leonard, the music publishing company.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And I started
more of
that.
I'm a Mel Bay guy, so I don't know if I'm on board, but whatever. Hal Leonard, fine. No one's heard
and
of him anyway.
So I somehow, despite the no travel, I've been like ridiculously busy.
Well, it's definitely the year of remote projects and I'm sure guest solos and all sorts of things thanks
like our
to technology
record.
And
tons
exactly.
Of guest
well, yeah,
solos.
Speaking of which, yeah. So obviously, you know, behind this podcast, the three of us are actually in a band, Lost Symphony, lostsymphony.com, and Alex graced us with some of his amazing guitar playing. So speaking of collaborations, thank you, of course, for
you
know,
you're welcome.
Elevating
you guys
us.
Are great. The music's really cool.
Can we tell him a quick story about Marty Friedman, because you might know this about him. So Marty Friedman, the reason we got all these amazing players together was because our friend Ollie Herbert, who is the guitar player of All That Remains, passed away, and we wanted to give him a tribute record.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That would really be the best thing. And you know, we used to joke around. When we started this project, he was a part of it, and we used to joke around. You know, who would be the best players we could possibly get for this symphonic instrumental rock project. And we'd always joke like, oh, Marty Friedman or Nuno Bettencourt. And when he passed, I went to every single one of the players that he loved the most. And we got Marty, we got Nuno, who are the two people we use as a joke. But when I spoke to Angel Vivaldi, the first thing he told me about Ollie was that they used to stay up all night listening to Testament and that they would just argue about which solo of yours was their favorite. And I had no
funny.
Connections to you. And then all of a sudden our marketing guy says, oh yeah, I'm friends with Skolnick. I duped him into playing. I 2020'd him into playing my wedding. And I'm like,
that's exactly right.
Which we have to talk about. But the thing that I'm about to tell you is that you play on a song called Take Another Piece and you play over Nuno and you play over Marty, but most importantly over Marty. And Marty said to me when he sent the tracks, don't have anyone play a single note over what I did. But then I sent it to Nuno Bettencourt, who's one of my personal favorites, Boston guy. Yeah. I mean, Portugal. I mean, one of the greatest guitar players. And I said, you know, don't play over Marty. And he goes, who's Marty? And I'm like, really? And he goes, whatever. And then he sends it back to me and there's playing all over Marty. And he said to me, he goes, you tell that Marty guy that if you're going to send a Boston boy a track that sounds like it's supposed to have a Boston harmony, I'm going to bring it home. So I already knew that it had been ruined that Marty might hate me. So I figured if we're going to have all three people playing, one thing Marty said to me, don't let anyone push you around and tell you what to do artistically, not even me. And I knew in my head, if Ollie saw Nuno Bettencourt, Marty Friedman, and Alex Skolnick playing together, despite Marty's hatred of collaborating with anyone else, he'd be very happy. So I want to say thank you for playing on that. I think he might be happy because what you delivered on that, I can't wait for everyone to hear. But I know Ollie up in heaven
to hear.
Is literally saying, I would never have guessed. I would never have thought this would happen.
Because, when I heard it, too, I wasn't totally clear on who was playing.
Good.
And I guess, some names were mentioned, but I didn't know who was playing. I just remember hearing those guys. I'm like, oh, my God, these guys can play. And
yeah, they're all right.
Marty, I do know. I don't know Nuno well. Yeah, much, obviously by reputation and much respect, but. And what an honor to be on with him. Marty, I have toured with in the past. We have a lot of history together. And over the years, people have asked us to collaborate. And we've talked about it. We've actually shared fan questions about collaborating. Last time I was in Japan in 2019, I met up with him in Japan, which was really cool.
Mr. Guitar.
We had sushi and just talked to him. But it's one of those things. I mean, we talk about collaborating. Actually having it happen is very difficult, but we're finally collaborating thanks to this project.
And Ollie.
That's very cool to know.
And Ollie, yes. Thank you, Ollie.
Yeah. We cannot wait to get this stuff out to the world. I think the stuff that you did and the project itself in its entirety is gonna blow people's minds. So we're really excited about it.
It made me tap into some stuff. No, pun not intended. there was a very just a very specific sound. I mean, I can certainly play fast. It's part of what I do, but I'm not somebody that it's not like the main thing I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be somebody who is able to play with the super fast people, but it's not my main thing. I'm not really playing specifically for fans of super fast playing. You know what I mean? Like, if I was on stage with that Project Generation X or whatever, that tour with Yngwie and Nuno and all those guys, I'm sure I could find something to play, but it's not really my main thing. But this made me really tap into the fast stuff and maybe go a little faster than I used to and go be a little more shreddy, but it was good. It was a good, good challenge. Cause I want my stuff to fit with those guys and those guys sound amazing.
Alex, one of the things that I love about you is that you're so tasty. You pick the right notes and that's much more important.
Thank you.
And I want to talk about this because I use this term, this metaphor to Pantera a lot. Pantera introduced double bass and they had this power groove and that was really heavy and it just made you move. But now you have all these super technical metal bands that sound quantized to a grid and they're playing these blast beats and these super fast shred sweep arpeggios. And for me, that's soulless. I could care less. One of the things I loved about Nuno is he sounds ferocious when he's playing. He sounds like he's moving his hair with his feathers and shit when he's playing. And there's bombast to it. And even Yngwie Malmsteen, when he came out, even though he's super fast and he's like a super shredder by any means, he still had that bombast and that bravado that from the second you heard his vibrato, it's him. Now I feel like there's all these players that they grew up in a world where there was auto-tune and quantization and they play like that. So yes, they can play super fast, but to sound like the second you come in on our song, it sounds like Alex Skolnick. And that is so much more important to me. You know, like even Jimmy Page, for example, Nuno was telling me when we first met, he's like, I don't like perfect. And I think he thought I liked the super shredding. And he's like, I like Jimmy Page. He messed up. He played like a real player. But I love that. And I think that that's devoid in a lot of music. And I'm sort of curious as a guy that is expected to be a guitar hero. How do you feel about these guys that are coming out that look like all they've done is sit in front of a computer learning Eddie's tricks since they were six?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I can respect it. It's very different from where I'm coming from. I don't need that. You know, there is music where, you know, the technicality is a part of it, and it gets me real. You know, I love it. And certainly I do. There's people who hear me and they think I'm like this super technical player, but I think when you listen to like the guys like you're talking about, that's a whole other thing. There's this whole other scientific level of shredding and like two-handed stuff that I'm not that interested in it. Like I'm sure I could devote a bunch of time if I said, okay, I'm going to take a year and I'm going to learn these new tricks and these new techniques. That's fine. I just don't have it in me. There's music I like that is really not that technical, but it's emotional. Mm-hmm. When it is technical and emotional, that's great too. But to me, like, it's just funny. Like to me, Van Halen, who, you know, who's like inspired me to play lead guitar in the first place, the early Van Halen stuff. That's like, you know, that's sort of old school now compared to some stuff that's happening. And I would still rather listen to somebody like him, because there's just so much soul, and I like soul. To me, Van Halen and maybe a few others who came after are about as fast as it gets with still having soul. Mm-hmm. That interests me, and I'm not knocking like the super perfect technical stuff. It's not really for me. There is some guitar out there that sounds like video game music to me.
Well, yeah. You can hum. If you can't hum it, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it's funny because I have a lot of these people that come in and they play, you know, a lot of these new bands that do that two-hand tapping, like crazy stuff. Look, when I saw Stanley Jordan for the first time play Over the Rainbow, it blew my fucking mind because he's playing two guitars or he's doing this double tapping thing.
Yeah.
But now there's some like 9-year-old in Dubai playing some crazy, like ridiculous, like 17 string something or another. And it's like, at what point do you say, like, are you saying anything with this? Because one of my favorite things that really put things relative to me, and I've said this to a few different guitar players, and I'm sure you were in the back of Guitar World magazine saying this, but they used to ask different guitar players one question. And I think one question they had asked was, what was your favorite guitar solo ever? And, you know, all these guys are like, I love, you know, Mr. Crowley. I love Jimi Hendrix. I love Aerosmith. I love that. And Trey Anastasio from Phish says, I won't tell you my favorite solo. I'll tell you my favorite note. And he said the power of love, Jimi Hendrix live at the Fillmore 1970. He said like 12 minutes into it, he holds out one note for about 45 seconds. And he said that he said more in that one note than Yngwie did on the entire Rising Force record. And
yeah,
that was like things turned for me from going, oh, you need to be the strongest Arnold Schwarzenegger on the guitar, or you just need to say something meaningful and drop the mic.
Yeah.
Maybe you have a lesson to learn from that, Ben.
Dropping the mic.
saying something meaningful in a short amount of time.
I think a lot of that is indicative of how, you know, guitarists can rise above the noise these days, which is mostly on social media and Instagram and TikTok and that stuff. Right. So they have to do something that's impressive to people without them having to put much, you know, investing much time into it. So if I have 30 seconds to gain someone's attention, I can't do a nice soulful blues lick because there's no one's going to sit there for that. So, but if I can do a crazy two-handing tapping lick that is actually physically impressive, technically impressive, I'm probably going to get more people going, oh, that's interesting. Like, click, I like that. Right. So I think it's just the way people digest
music.
What
your motivation is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you trying to say something musically, or is it like a, you know, a strongman performance? You know, like a carnival.
Exactly.
Like
who
can lift the biggest weight and who can, you know, who can put on the biggest show. And maybe, you know, there's something to that. It just, yeah, it doesn't interest me. It stopped interesting me a long time ago. and the stuff, the fast stuff that I was into, Eddie, Randy Rhodes, I did like, you know, the first couple albums that Yngwie did. I was a fan and I was learning his stuff.
I'm not even shitting on Yngwie. I love Yngwie, by the way. I think he was great.
Yeah, I mean, Yngwie serves a purpose too. And there was also no, when he came out, nobody sounded like
that. Yeah, that's the key.
So, yeah, so no, I give props to Yngwie, but it's, there's, he sort of started a whole, there's a whole following that started after Yngwie. And, you know, some players did really interesting things with it. Like, one, there's guitar players who were very, I can't imagine them doing their thing without Yngwie, which would be Paul Gilbert, mm-hmm. for example, or Buckethead.
Yeah.
And these are super fast playing, but those guys have these brought this quirky personality into it. And I think it made it more interesting.
Paul's a little bit more endearing than Yngwie, I feel.
Well, Paul's, you know, he's got very diverse musical tastes, and he's a Todd Rundgren fan. He speaks about Todd Rundgren all the time. So, that's a different thing. But I do think for every person like that, there's just so many other players that were just doing that sounded so similar. The whole post Yngwie neoclassical thing. And now you've got a similar thing happening. With, you know, more modern burning players.
Look, like, we actually took Vivaldi and played Vivaldi. So just so you know, on our record Lost Symphony, we just played Paganini and we played Schubert because we said, you know what? Instead of just stealing it and paraphrasing it, we're just going to play it. So, but that's what it sounded like for me after a while with a lot of that neoclassical movement was it went from having like that real fury that, you know, obviously fury with Yngwie to kind of just sounding like, okay, you've listened to Paganini's 24 Caprices, like clearly, and Richie Blackmore. Good for you.
Yeah, I think with any movement, there tends to be, yeah, there's the original, and then it starts to get watered down. You know, in after Van Halen, I mean, in L.A., like every sort of commercial hard rock band had a soloist now. Suddenly, guitar solos were important. And yeah, a few were definitely great soloists and should have been featured. Warren DeMartini of Rat, those solos mm-hmm. still sound great. George Lynch, for example. There's others, I won't name them, but it's like they were sort of trying to do the same thing, but it wasn't quite working, but it became this cliche. Like, you had to have that. You had to have the big solo. And I think that's happened in, you know, various shred movements, whether it was people that followed Yngwie or people who try to play like, you know, Guthrie Govan, who I think is, you know, an incredible player doing some very different stuff. I don't even touch the stuff that some of that stuff he does. But then there are the imitators that follow along.
Sure.
And I think it's just better not to try to be an imitator. You know, I take what I can from different players. Eddie was certainly a big influence, but it, you know, I try not to make it too obvious, and I try to base it on what I like. And there's a lot of music I like that isn't, as I said this earlier, it's not technical at all, but that might come out while I'm playing technical music because I want a melody that's memorable, something that fits the song. That's another thing that was so great about Eddie and, you know, the early, you know, technical players is that it, no matter what, it fit the song. And some players seem to forget about that.
Right.
Yeah. I'd like to take it back a bit before we get carried away. You know, just for anyone that maybe hasn't read your book or doesn't know a lot about you, you have a really interesting story, and I'm interested to hear how you did find this voice and this space that you fit into in terms of your guitar playing. Can you maybe tell the listeners a little bit about your upbringing growing up in Berkeley? I've laughed like so many times at some of the ways that you described where you grew up, you know, especially having been on tour there before and how you see it as an outsider. And it was so funny to hear what it was like to actually grow up there and your experience experience with your parents and learning music. So maybe if you could just tell the listeners a little bit about some of that, you know, growing up and how you got into guitar.
Yeah, well, I found myself in this metal scene in the Bay Area when I was very young. So I joined the band Testament when I was in 11th grade. And I wanted to play in a band that was already playing. And at that time, it wasn't as common for people to be playing guitar as a 15-year-old and have several years under their belt. Like, a lot of teens were starting guitar. Now people start much younger. But I needed to be in an existing band. And it's just funny because the metal scene, there's a lot of folks who kind of came from different backgrounds where they were sort of expected to get a real job, you know, and a real job might be, I don't know, a machinist or working at a, you know, having a union job, some kind of labor. I grew up surrounded by Sigmund Freud books and Foucault and boring PBS programming.
This sounds like my childhood.
Yeah. You don't like Bob Ross?
I very much related to this.
Bob Ross is the best. Was the best. Is the best. Still the best. Was that WGBH?
Yeah, no, I love Bob. But my family, they're academics, and the reason I grew up in Berkeley is because of UC Berkeley, and my father was a law professor. My mother wrote psychology textbooks. You know, they both have, you know, like advanced doctoral degrees from Yale. And I was not on that track. They kind of saw, I didn't like school. I didn't like school sports. I didn't like the whole culture. I was very introverted, less so now, but extremely introverted then. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that I was good at, that I could find was good at, was guitar and rock music. And it was sort of never a question that I was going to carve out some kind of existence around guitars and music. It just...
But you had to kind of resist I don't want to say pressure, but I mean, from what I've read, it seems like you didn't necessarily have the ideal situation of, you know, having that support, like, you know, go do music. And this is interesting to me because, you know, for me, I grew up in kind of a similar environment with very academic parents that kind of had their own ideas. And now my mom's very supportive of me being in music, but it was similar. It's like, if you're not going to go to some, you know, doctorate or professional law doctor type thing, like, arts is just kind of a side thing, you know? So it's interesting to me that you made something of it, because I think a lot of people get discouraged and quit and they lose that vision growing up in that environment.
That's exactly right. It was also a time period where, I guess parents of a certain generation, they kind of expected their offspring to follow in their footsteps. And, it was not a musical family. They were from New York. Ironically, I ended up moving to New York later in life and sort of rediscovered my New Yorkness. But they'd come from New York, so we were separate from other relatives. And it's not like I had like an uncle or anything who played. Like, nobody played. Mm-hmm. I was like completely on my own. I had an older brother who played, and he played some clubs. He kind of never got beyond playing clubs, but, music, it was just seen as this horrible thing. And I think since then, there's just been a lot more, like, parenting has changed, right? You're supposed to, you know, almost to a fault, like, everything is encouraged. You're great at everything. Tell you, you know. And that's I don't know, that doesn't make sense. That's like
opposite extreme.
The opposite extreme, exactly. But so it was, overcoming that was really tough. But I think it helped that I was in a place that it had this interesting history, because Berkeley was this, it was like stuck in the 60s. So we had on the streets, people still wore tie-dye, you know, like they were at a Grateful Dead concert in the late 60s, except this is the 1980s, and incense everywhere. And it was really like stuck in that time. Haight-Ashbury wasn't that far away. But then somehow this heavy rock and metal scene developed, and I was there just as that was happening. So like the band Exodus was formed by Kirk Hammett, and they quickly just started playing clubs, and they were doing really well. And you know, they tell the story really well, but like Metallica had formed in Southern California, where they hated it. They were just these outcasts, and they played in the Bay Area, and they met Exodus, and it was like a shock. Like, wow, we're all into the same kind of heavy music. And then obviously, you know, we all know the story. Kirk Hammett joins Metallica. They become this massive band. But in their wake, this whole other scene developed. So you had the post-Kirk Hammett version of Exodus, and they're still playing. Anthrax is coming out from New York and playing the Bay Area. Megadeth, because the reason Kirk Hammett is in Metallica is because they kicked out a guy named Dave Mustaine.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Who
of course
forms a band called Megadeth that does their very first show in Berkeley, my hometown. You know?
Yeah, I read his memoir and I remember that. That's cool. Yeah.
And I'm one of the few people that's actually from Berkeley. Like most...
Were you at the show? People, like, Dave Mustaine wants to know.
What's that?
Were you at the show at Berkeley? Dave Mustaine wants to personally know. Were you there, Alex?
Oh, no.
Did you witness it?
I was not. I was not. But they played there. They kept playing there. They played there a number of times. And one of those times, one of the support acts was the band that would become Testament. So I missed. I mean, there were so many shows. You couldn't possibly go to all these shows. And I'm still in. I guess at this point, I'm in the 10th grade. So I'm in the 10th grade, and my whole circle of friends, they're getting into going to local shows. I never knew there were local shows. Yeah. Like I got my brother to take me to Kiss when I was 10. My buddy's older brother took us to Van Halen.
What lineup of Kiss was it?
The lineup.
So it was the original lineup before.
The last one. I was 10 years old. Yeah, the very last. I had no idea. And I heard they had a fist fight before. Like, I'm finding all this out later, but
sounds about
to
right.
Me, that was the greatest concert, you know, to this day. I still
they
can't
told
remember
you at the beginning. Don't you know that? Like, they came out and said they're the greatest band in the land.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I
and
believe
they only that. Play the best, Alex.
Right. That's right. Gibson guitars and Pearl drums.
Well, that's why Dave Mustaine plays Gibson now, is because
he even...
It all comes around.
He literally
around.
Said that. Yes.
It all comes around.
Right. So it's all full circle. So I had been to those concerts. So I'd seen Kiss at the Cow Palace. That's the arena in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I had seen Van Halen. I think it was at the Oakland Coliseum, that arena. I didn't know there's clubs. Like, bands play small. Oh, so, you know, a few years later. So my brother's playing clubs. I'm going with friends, and I'm checking out these same clubs where, like, the first Megadeth show was. And I didn't catch the first Megadeth show. I did catch the first Slayer show in the Bay Area. And they did another show where Exodus supported them and apparently had a come-to-Jesus talk with them and said because they were wearing, Slayer was wearing makeup at the time. And like they were totally, they still had the Southern California theatrical thing.
So basically Kirk Hammett walked in and said, hell awaits for you, Kerry King.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, he was gone by that point, but the rest of the guys. Yes. So I caught the very first Slayer show. I think it was the first time Anthrax came through on tour. The Anthrax 1.0. like pre Joey Belladonna. And then somehow I kept missing Testament, which was called Legacy at the time. But friends of mine would say, dude, you got to hear this band. This band's great. They're, you know. And then, yeah, I'm in the 10th grade. And then by the time I'm in the 11th grade, this is yeah, around the time their original guitar player leaves the band for some reason. And then I get the word, oh, this band is looking for a guitar player. And at that point, another great thing about being in the Bay Area, for all my complaints about it, the guitar teacher that a bunch of us studied with, the guys in Exodus, the guys in a band called Possessed, which was that early like death metal band where the guitarist was Larry Lalonde. He would later join a band called Primus. The guy that we all studied with was named Joe Satriani, and he was teaching in a little guitar shop, and we were all kind of scratching our heads going, why is this guy not more well known? This is insane. And it was actually, we would hear from our parents about how the music business, you know, is terrible and you should not even attempt to enter the music business because this guy, if people have not heard of this guy, what hope is there for anybody else? But you know, obviously within a few years everybody would hear about Joe Satriani. So mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was kind of this incredible time. So for all my frustrations and pressures to go into academia, which I did not appreciate at the time. I actually appreciate it more now. I've, you know, I pay more attention. I read more than I used to back then, but back then it was just music. I felt so passionately about music and I could not imagine not doing that. But, the fact that I was there where all these bands were, originating and the scene was originating and musicians like Joe Satriani, that was, you know, were well-kept secrets. Was amazing. And I was very lucky. And then that's kind of how it all began.
What do you think it was about the Bay Area that really fostered that scene? Because it's interesting how LA was obviously so different and certain things didn't work there that worked in the Bay Area. Like what was there something about the vibe or the culture? Because obviously so many of these bands that we now know as legendary originated in this era, in this geographic location. So what do you think, what was the common thread there?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. It's hard to pinpoint it exactly, but I think there are two forms of rebellion that had a lot to do with it. One of them was the fallout from the 60s. The fact that 60s culture was everywhere. And, you know, with total respect to, you know, Joan Baez and Grateful Dead and, you know, sort of more uplifting music, you know, the summer of love, flower power, you know?
Right.
We're growing up and we're just so sick of it at that point. And then we discover Motorhead and Iron Maiden and Judas Priest and Black Sabbath. And it's just like, you know, angry and like ugly in a way, in a beautiful way, you know, just brutally honest, like the complete opposite of that music. So I think that was a part of it. And then I think when it came to the club scene and the kind of emerging bands, there was a rebellion against Southern California, because Southern California was certainly more, we were sort of always in the shadow of Southern California. You know, nationally, when people think of California, Southern California comes to mind first. It's got Hollywood, right?
Right.
LA, you know, it's the main metropolitan region on the West Coast. So the bands that are coming from there are just completely different than in the Bay Area. Like, there's just a open hostility in the Bay Area to bands like Rat and Dokken, even though those are bands I like the guitar players, but I don't know. Poison came out, and
the image with those bands,
we hated them.
Yeah,
like if we saw somebody with a shirt, a Poison shirt, it was like a sports, like the ugliest sports rivalry.
Yeah,
it was like, you know, seeing, it was like, you know, the Red Sox versus the Yankees.
But do you feel like the converse is true? Because I remember when I was in high school and I'd like walk around with an Iron Maiden shirt, and like I went to an all guys Catholic high school. So when it, like I wore, you know, a suit to school basically, or a jacket and shit. So when, like, when you had, like, I'd show my Iron Maiden shirt and I'd walk around the neighborhood and you'd see someone else with a Megadeth shirt or an Anthrax or a Testament shirt. You guys always kind of gave each other the eyes. Like, I know that dude's cool. Like, we could be friends. And like, I feel like a lot of things with metal now is like, I mean, there always was a rivalry, but one of the things I feel like with metal is that there's a camaraderie in the fact that when it's not mainstream, people who see other metalheads, it's like, oh, you're one of us. Like, just like you see someone, the Red Sox versus someone who's wearing Yankees. It's very, you know, ethnocentric.
Yeah. Yeah. It's changed too. It's changed over the years. I think, also, the early part of the 80s, you know, the whole the glam metal LA influence was so big. And even bands that weren't from LA, you know, if you look at like Bon Jovi during that period, that's not even an LA band. They're from New Jersey. But originally, when they came out, yeah, they completely had, they looked like they were from LA. Cinderella. All these other bands. And even, you know, the great Kiss, you know, who had just done some of my favorite music. And they're in LA and they're destroyed from being in LA. They, like, look at pictures of Kiss at that time. Like, just Paul Stanley's leopard pants and, you know, Gene with his weird, like, they're all wearing these weird colors. And so the Bay Area was just, it was a hotbed of defiance against that, against that kind of commercialism and imagery. And we were sort of very proud to just, you know, have our, you know, be like more like the people's music. Yeah, you know?
That makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Jeans and the bands wore jeans and t-shirts.
Right.
And it just felt much more honest and direct.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, once you did join up with Testament and how that, you know, going from watching these shows to being a part of that scene, you know, worked for you?
Well, I was just talking about this, about how nervous I was when I did my first show. The first show was with a band that's still around, actually, Death Angel. They were very young at the time, and my band was a bit older. But I was very young. I was like in the Death Angel wing, so I was the kid. I could not. I could barely hold the pick. I was so nervous.
Wow.
Yeah. I recently described it as like a thrill ride.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you get on a roller coaster. You're terrified, but afterwards you're pumped with adrenaline and you're ready to go on again. That was what it's like. And then our next show was in San Francisco at a venue called The Stone, a very legendary place. And with each concert, I just got a little bit less nervous and a little less nervous, and a little more comfortable. And then by the time we were... I guess by the time we signed our record deal, I was like just out of high school, and basically a lot of my friends were starting college, and right the fall after graduation, and I had plane tickets and hotels booked to record our first record. And then the following summer, we went on tour, and we were on Megaforce Records, which was distributed by Atlantic Records. So we sort of indirectly have a major label deal. And the bands we're touring with are all, at first, are bands that are connected to Megaforce Records. So Anthrax, whose management was the heads of Megaforce Records, Marcia Zazula, may she rest in peace, and most notably Johnny Z, the founder, John Zazula. And Overkill, another man, New York heavy band that's still around. We toured with them. So even though, you know, when I was 16 when I did my first show, I was 18 when I did the first album, and then followed that with a tour. Once you go on tour, then that's a whole other level, because then you have just night after night to fine tune and learn how to do this, learn how to, get in a zone, how to handle mistakes, or if you don't, problems with the monitor, things that happen. You just learn to roll with the punches. And I just think if you get through a tour and you're able to handle it, and the lack of sleep, and got your band getting on each other's nerves, and all the things that go wrong, and things to, if you get through that, like it just, you're on this whole other level. Suddenly it's not like you're this club band of newbies anymore. And then with each tour, you reach a different plateau.
So being that young when all this, you're basically talking like a 2-3 year period, going from like, oh, you can go see bands in clubs, to like, oh, we're touring, and I'm signed to a record label. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's kind
and,
of
and I think you mentioned your friends are going off to college, and doing these things, that there's a kind of a clear roadmap for that lifestyle. So for you, how do you think you handled that, personally, going into this very almost elite career path that's doesn't have a lot of information that you can kind of get until you're there and in it?
It's a big learning experience in many ways. So you just learn a lot. You learn a lot about the about the world really fast. Mm-hmm. And you learn that the things they're teaching you in school, all the facts and figures, they're not all that useful. And you learn a lot. You learn about, people's motivations, and yes, you should be nice to everybody. Everybody deserves a chance, but not everybody deserves your trust. Mm-hmm. Your trust must be earned. Yeah, it was a real awakening in a way. Yeah.
Did you guys have any guidance from maybe more veteran bands and artists?
Not really. No. We kind of had to figure it out as we went along. And it's just weird too, because I'm just out of school, which has its own hierarchies, right? It's kind of false social hierarchies. And mm-hmm. people who are very popular and considered successful in school, I mean, you hear about this all the time. They're just become completely lost and directionless after school. And then there's others that are just invisible, that people are underestimated and nobody knows they exist. And they end up like doing something with their lives and having some huge impact on the world. Yeah. So I'd kind of been this invisible kid in school that just, not popular. Just not, nobody you would notice, especially. And then suddenly I'm in this band, and then once the record starts selling and people are familiar with the band, I was never like tabloid level famous or anything, but enough so that we could do these tours, and you know, you get a lot of attention all of a sudden. And then, mm-hmm. you know, you're in this town and you're, you know, around the venue, all the bars and maybe record stores around the, you know, there's people that are going to your concert, and suddenly, you know, they recognize you and they want to, and it's just, it's very strange. It's very strange to get used to that.
Yeah.
And then how to, just put that in perspective and talk to people. And like, you know, if you're like, you know, you get into playing music partially because, so you don't have to talk to people, you're not good at talking to people, but suddenly everybody wants, you're in these crowds where everybody wants to say, so you kind of have to, learn how to navigate that. And, mm-hmm. I was talking to somebody recently, that got much, much more famous than me, like tabloid level famous, and talking about like that. And it was very relatable. Like I never experienced it on this level that this person was talking about, but it was enough so that, yeah, it's kind of the same thing. And some deal with it very well. I mean, you see a couple great examples, I think. Like, if you look at, say, Ringo Starr now, or Paul McCartney, right? These are just, they seem like just so at ease and at peace. And I've never met them, but I know several folks who have, and people who've worked with them. And apparently, you know, they're delightful. And they know everybody wants to talk to them. And they give everybody attention, but they can also be people. They can, and then there's you see others that, you know, maybe I won't mention any names, but that are just tortured by it.
Britney Spears,
yeah, just Britney
Spears.
Yeah, sure. At her,
the poor girl. I'm not even joking. Like, the poor girl went nuts, shaved her head, and then her dad took all of her money from her, and now she's like free Britney. Hashtag free Britney.
It's really disconcerting what happened to her. Yeah.
Very disconcerting.
Whatever you think of her music.
It's like a Stanley Kubrick film, dude. It's like she gets so famous, she has the most hits, and now she's like trapped in her own world and cesspool of money and her family trying to take advantage of her.
Right. And you're right. Meltdowns, public meltdown. I mean, that just seems awful to me.
Horrifying.
Amy Winehouse, that's mm-hmm. another good example. And there's a great documentary on her. So I'm glad I never had to experience like that level of celebrity. But even if you're just, you know, a band that tours and you're in magazines targeted to a specific demographic, you know, you're going to have to learn how to navigate and deal with fans. Having fans, it's a strange thing. I mean, I don't even think about it anymore because I've had it for so long, and but at first it can be really strange. They really should give like a course.
I was just gonna say it's a skill set that not many people have or need to have, but it's something that, you know, it stood out to me because you were so young that you were forced to develop at least some semblance of you know, a way of coping with that and handling that and not going crazy. Because I think of myself at that age, and I was an idiot. There's no way I would have handled anything like that.
A lot of us are. Yeah. It's rare. It's rare to have. I mean, Justin Bieber. That's another example, and it's not. Not that his music's relatable in any way to what we do. But just, that was painful to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what's going on with him now, but I think he came out of it okay. Like, he's not in the tabloids.
Dude, Dennis Leary called this in 1990 a no cure for cancer. When he said, like, you know, you just go through this whole phase of, like, you know, doing all these bad things and being terrible and doing drugs, and then you rehabilitate yourself, and then everyone loves you again. But the thing is, with a guy like Justin Bieber, you could say that, but like, he grew up and he was so young, by the time he was like, you know what, 14, 15, he's like hyper wealthy. He's in front of everybody. Everyone's paying attention. Miley Cyrus, another example. And you know, Miley Cyrus is a fantastic musician. Miley Cyrus is a great person. But these people had to have like almost meltdowns because there was so much money, so many people whispering in their ears. And like, what the hell do you do when you're literally living in La La Land? I mean, you hear stories about Prince.
She seems to have come out on the other side. And Justin Bieber, he's kind of become this mentor for Billie Eilish, which I thought was really cool. I did see a clip of him interviewed about her and just said, you know, I'm looking after her. Like, I do not want what happened to me to happen to her. Which I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
And again, this is not something any of us will experience, but just a little bit of it that, you know, we deal with, playing, you know, large clubs or small theaters. And when you start to get attention, I've seen that completely break people down, and there is no instruction manual. And, it can be very strange. It took me a few years, I think, to sort of get used to it and kind of get some perspective.
Took my entire 20s, dude. You're like 18. You're like a few years. By the time I was 21, I was well adjusted.
Yeah. No, it wasn't like that.
I was onto the Dorian mode.
That's something that I think all our viewers and listeners, you know, it's like a peek behind the curtain of they try to, you know, try to picture yourself at that age and doing some of the cool stuff that you're doing. It just the stuff you don't think about, that there is other sides of that business. As, you know, the band continued and grew, and, you know, you mentioned you guys are now touring, so you're getting tighter, you're doing all these things. Can you talk a little bit about how that trajectory went?
Yeah, it was an interesting trajectory. Like, we never really had a big break.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got the break of having a record label interested in us, but it wasn't some, you know, massive record deal. We weren't like groomed by anyone. It was sort of, we pretty much were, you know, the band. We were in the clubs. We were allowed to sort of be that band on record, and, you know, and tour with, Anthrax for the first year. Then our first tour in Europe the next year, for the second album, was with Megadeth. Headlining on the third tour, headlining large theaters, and then finally, like, supporting classic acts. We supported Judas Priest in the early 90s. We supported Iron Maiden. That was a big thrill. But at the same time, you know, there was this sort of, disillusion in a way, because, yeah, we're playing with Judas Priest, but we're opening. Right. And, you know, a large part of that crowd is not there to see us. And
is that hard in metal, like, being with bands being so divisive? Like, you know, because I remember going and seeing, like, you know, Ozzy, and no one fucking cares who's on before Ozzy, you know. Or you go see Metallica a lot. I mean, obviously doing the Big Four was, like, you know, an example of, like, people caring. But most of the time, if you're some new band and they throw Days of the New on before Metallica, it's like, good luck, dude. Or before Slayer, like, extra good luck. Like, did you feel like you guys were ever able to overcome that? Or there was an audience that started off, it was going to turn into an Axl Rose meltdown, and then it turned into, like, everyone loving you guys?
Yeah. Well, it depends. Like, we did do a tour with Slayer for Seasons in the Abyss. I think that was 91. And that was more our crap. But, like, Judas Priest and Iron Maiden, you're dealing with, a lot of folks that are sort of next generation, like, older generation.
Yeah.
And they don't really get this fast stuff. So playing to, you know, kind of half-filled arenas, it was a bit of a wake-up call. It wasn't the dream that I thought it would be. And then I was also really growing as a musician. So I started my whole jazz instrumental side of things around that time. and I'd been playing for a number of years, like on the side, studying jazz guitar, because I figured I don't want to stop developing just because I'm sort of, you know, I have this career playing thrash metal, but I love Miles Davis and I love John Scofield. Like, I'm connecting to all this other music. So I would study with great jazz musicians when I wasn't on the road. And then eventually I got a gig playing instrumental music, my first gig outside of metal. And that was a great bass player named Stu Hamm, who had been the bass player for my former teacher, Joe Satriani. He was also bassist for Steve Vai, and kind of from that world. But his own music is different. He's got some kind of instrumental rock shred stuff, but he has other songs that are much more sort of jazz rock. He's got Alan Holdsworth guesting on one track. He's got Eric Johnson guesting on another. And suddenly I get his gig. Testament decides to take a year off. And yeah, this was also amazing timing. And during that time, Stu Hamm hires me to do this. This requires like learning Holdsworth and Eric Johnson, you know, this really advanced guitar stuff. So it really kind of helped me develop my guitar skills. Like, it really made me, you know, it was a
great motivation. Were you ever nervous? Like, when Stu Hamm sat you down and said, hey, man, there's this guy, Alan Holdsworth. I mean, rest in peace. But there was this guy, Alan Holdsworth, who was...
I already knew about Alan Holdsworth.
Well, I mean, I know you do, but the listeners and the people, right, they may not know the level of insanity that is. So for people that don't know, if you've seen American Ninja Warrior, the Americans that make it to Mount Midoriyama, that's Alan Holdsworth on the guitar.
Right.
Is that fair?
Right. And he was Eddie Van Halen's biggest influence. I mean, rightfully so. Yeah.
Because he's
his
that
most
level.
Notable influence. Yeah. I did an episode of my podcast. I did a tribute to Eddie. May he rest in peace. And it's so hard to find anything in Eddie's playing that sounds like lifted from anybody else. Maybe a riff here and there. You could say, oh, okay. And, you know, And the Cradle Will Rock. You could compare that to, you know, Skynyrd Saturday Night Special. Mm-hmm. You could compare like the Van Halen Boogie.
He did copy himself. He took the end of Jump and made that top of the, Top of the World or whatever, Standing on Top of the World from Fern Lawful Carnal Knowledge. So he used it with both the Van Hagar and the David Lee Roth era and just said, fuck it, I love that riff so much, I'm going to make it a new song, and it charted.
Well, he was very creative. He would do stuff like that often. And like the Van Halen Boogie Woogie stuff from like I'm the One, Hot for Teacher, you can trace that back to LaGrange, a ZZ Top, just like hyped up for... Mm. So you could find... You know, maybe what inspired the Van Halen stuff, but it's so hard to find like a lick that sounds like anything else. And I found one, and it's in of all solos, "Beat It" by Michael Jackson. He does a lick, and if you play it right next to a Jean-Luc Ponty track called "Enigmatic Ocean" that has Alan Holdsworth on guitar, it's okay. There, that's the same lick.
You're like guitar Shazam.
That's amazing.
That's what you are. Like, you literally I know it's that song. Like, the level of insanity to know that, Alex Skolnick.
Yeah. I'll just to finish that thought, I was already listening to Alan Holdsworth because Eddie Van Halen would talk about him, but it never occurred to me to learn his stuff because it was so far out. But suddenly I'm playing with Stu, and there's a song that Holdsworth played on, and he didn't want me to copy the solo exact, thank goodness. But
good,
I really had to dive into that. It really sort of took things next level. And I think I came off of that and I was just, you know, I was all about Holdsworth. I was all about Scofield, Matheny. Like, I was really, that side was really developing. And then the next year, 1992, I would kind of go off on my own. and sort of explore that and later come back, which is a whole other story. That was really where that side of things began.
And we hope our listeners will come back. But before
we end this,
Alex, can you tell us where everyone can hear your podcast and where we can find out all the stuff and hear the Alex Skolnick Trio and get Testament swag and anything else you want to drop?
And the book.
And your book.
The book that I'm reading.
Yes. I'm so glad you're reading that. So, so cool.
Yeah. That's awesome.
So if all my main handles online for Instagram and Twitter, it's just at Alex Skolnick. I reserved my name before anybody else grabbed it.
Nice.
Which often happens.
I bet.
Yeah.
Making the real alexskolnick.com right now.
Okay. Well, no. So I have that, but that's my YouTube.
Ah.
And that's kind of my fault because I did a channel for just for my trio on YouTube and called that Alex Skolnick.
Ah, there you
but,
go.
So all my non-trio stuff is under the real Alex Skolnick on YouTube. And Facebook, there's Alex Skolnick fan page. But it's all linked to, and on the web, alexskolnick.com and alexskolnick.net. If you just look at Alex Skolnick, like my Instagram links to everything.
Yeah. I think everyone's Alexas are going off right now, and you're just coming up. In fact, I actually had an old guy call me the other day and said, am I listening to Benny Goodman? And I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, I asked Alexa to put on Benny Goodman, and he actually called my cell phone from Alexa. That's a true story. Awesome. And on that note, you've been 2020. Please subscribe and listen to Alex Skolnick. And what can you tell us the name of your podcast so everyone can listen?
Oh, yeah. So my podcast is called Moods and Modes with Alex Skolnick.
That's awesome.
And it's
love that.
It's on the Osiris Media Network. They have Oteil Burbridge from Dead & Company. They have Eric Krasnow from Soul Live. They have a lot of, I think you mentioned Phish earlier. They have a lot of Phish podcasts. Yeah. So it's kind of more on the jam band side of things, but they're just great musicians, great content. And it's a really cool network to be a part of. And you can find Moods and Modes on all your podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and it lives on alexskolnick.net.
Subscribe.
Cool.
Thank you, as always, for checking out this episode of 2020. Please visit 2020-D.com. Like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes. This week's throwback clip is from episode number 57, featuring Doc Coyle of Bad Wolves. Check it out.
Yeah, but if you're in a band that made a name, and then that band breaks up, there's a lot of people who kind of want to write you off as like, oh, you were this thing and you're this other thing. But I never let that get to me. Like, I never was like, oh, just because that person doesn't believe I can do blank. I just didn't think that way. I always felt like, well, I'm here, I'm now. Like, that was then, this is now. So it's all about, and I don't care. I was never like too good to like do any gig or play any venue. Like, I was like, to me, being a musician is just a very blue-collar thing.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant, evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of The Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.